Hello, and welcome to I Am The Egg Pod with me, Chris Shaw. The Egg Pods take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland, discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this episode, I'm joined by editor, media desk at the New York Times, and a writer whose profiles range from Elvis Costello and Robert Plant to Rufus Wainwright and Nick Lowe. It's Jim Windolph.
Hi, Chris. Thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you. I've been reading a lot of your stuff. I've been reading your Silly Love Songs appraisal.
Oh, good. Thank you for reading
that. There's a story to that, you were saying.
Yeah, I wrote this kind of ode to Silly Love Songs because I felt like it was unfairly maligned. I am a big defender of Silly Love Songs. It was the number one, the highest selling song of 1976 in the United States. And so I wrote this thing about it where I partially used it to defend Linda as a singer. And I think she adds so much to post-Beatles Paul McCartney, you know. And on that song, I love when she sings in the rounds section where it's, you know, I love you, how can I tell you about my loved one? And kind of made this argument that her lack of like professional singer's tricks makes you believe the words more, because it's just, there's no vibrato, there's nothing, it's just I love you. And I'm sure Paul is like the way James Brown was with his band, I'm sure Paul is like telling her, hit this, do this, do that, you know, that. I think he's on top of her. I mean, that there are, you can read about that where he takes her through these vocal parts very strictly, in a way. Anyway, sounds great. So after I posted this thing, you know, as a blog item a couple years ago, and then 3 days later, at my apartment in New York, I got a package and opened it, and it was a coffee table book of Linda McCartney's photographs with a note with just a heart and signed Stella from Stella McCartney. And it seemed, you know, now it's possible that because of my job, she meant to send it to me at the New York Times for some reason, but I don't really, at the time I wasn't really covering music or anything. But I think since it came to my home address, which somebody had to look for at her company, and that she would go that far out of her way, it made me think that maybe she appreciated the defense of her mom, you know, or something like that, I guess. But I'm surprised that if that's what happened, if it wasn't a coincidence, I'm surprised that she would pay attention to something like that or that they would care.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. I love that.
Yeah. It's a beautiful book too. Yeah. So,
yeah. Just for the record, can I take this opportunity to say I love Mary McCartney's photos if anybody's listening?
Yeah, that's good. Maybe like a lot of McCartney fans, I went through a period in my teenage years where I became embarrassed of my earlier love for McCartney, which started when I was six. And so I was about 12 when Silly Love Songs came out, so I was still all right with it. But a couple of years later, I had to disown it and then become a closet Paul McCartney fan.
Yeah.
But then I was in a kind of high school garage band, and the leader of our band had a lot of friends in his neighborhood who were just Paul McCartney solo work freaks. And the brother of our keyboard player played this version of Maybe I'm Amazed in his house one day. And it just knocked me out so much. And he was so serious about it that I realized, I was no longer embarrassed about my love for McCartney and Wings.
Yeah. So were you at such a tender age, were you a Wings fan who became a Beatles fan, or vice versa?
I guess a little vice versa. I had, when I was really little, babysitters who would tell me about the Beatles and, you know, spin the stories and that kind of thing. And I do have vague memories of hearing Let It Be on the radio. You know, I was about five or six, you know, when it was new.
Yeah.
But Uncle Albert was really the first song that I fell in love with. And I still feel exactly the same about it now, you know, as I did when I first heard it. I just loved it. And Junior's Farm and Band on the Run, they were all big for me. And then Venus and Mars, the album we were going to talk about, is the one of the first albums I bought myself. I remember at the same time, the other records I got that around that time were Captain Fantastic, the Elton John album. Oh, yeah. And Station to Station, and for some reason, Red Octopus by Jefferson Starship.
Oh, wow. Diverse collection, though.
Yeah.
But so you've chosen Wings' fourth album from May 1975, Venus and Mars. So what made you pick this one?
I think it has a very particular mood, and, you know, it's like its own weird world. It still sounds great, I think, as a whole. It works as a whole. There's only one big hit on the album, Listen to What the Man Said, and it's kind of tucked away in the back, and when it comes up, you're almost surprised that it's on there. It's like, oh, you know, who puts the hit second to last or whatever it is on the album? And also, it's kind of McCartney at the height of his solo commercial power. You know, he announced that he was going to do this 2-year tour right as he started making this record. And a lot of it, I think, is written for the stage, like the opening songs, which he did open the tour with for basically a year and a half. So it's weirdly forgotten. I think Band on the Run is, you know, more talked about these days. This is the follow-up. It sold well. It didn't, the reviews were surprisingly not bad. There was some nasty stuff, like in NME, there was a withering piece, and a couple, you know, Rolling Stone didn't love it, but otherwise the reviews were saying, oh, it's has a little more variety than Band on the Run, but it's a, you know, very nice follow-up. You know, that's how most people seem to think of it at the time, which surprised me. I thought it might've gotten slagged, but it doesn't seem to be the case.
Yeah. And I remember you saying that, primarily on this podcast, we're guilty of it. No one really cites this. You know, you remember, I love Ram. You know, it's a bit like Ram, or it's a bit like Band on the Run. No one really mentions this album, and it was massive.
Yeah, and also, it's easier to talk about something like, excuse me, Wildlife or McCartney 2, even, because they're so odd. And this one is really right. You know, it's mainstream. It's pop. And there's nothing. It is a little weird, but it's not as I don't know. It's hard. It's not, doesn't provide as much stuff for conversation maybe as those two albums or some of the oddball albums that he's put out.
Yeah, I think a lot of the conversation about this could be the backdrop with the ever-changing Wings lineup, which is a theme on that. This is quite almost veering into Carry On movie territory. Back in April 1974, they were without a drummer. It was basically the Band on the Run lineup with just Paul, Denny and Linda. So they held auditions at the Albert Theatre in London, and it was Paul and Denny who were the judges. And one of the drummers who turned up was Mitch Mitchell from the Jimi Hendrix Experience. And he was a bit perturbed that he had to actually have an audition. And to be fair, it's probably, what an amazing drummer, but you can't really hear him playing Wings songs, in all fairness.
He'd also have to be a good soldier on the road for 2 years, and, you know, it is hard to imagine.
Yeah. So, also part of that audition was Jeff Britton, who was in the UK amateur karate team and a black belt, and he was possibly, I don't know, character-wise, not really suited to the band, shall we say.
Yep. He didn't drink or smoke marijuana. And after Jimmy McCullough joined the band on guitar, they really fought each other constantly. It seems like Jimmy McCullough could be a difficult character who would get in your face, and it seems he and Jeff Britton really didn't get along. So I think in the end, they did do a few sessions at Abbey Road for this album, and Jeff Britton is on those songs, two or three songs, but he's not in the official listing of the band members in the lineup that appears on the back of the album. He's kind of credited as a guest drummer.
Yeah. He lasted a while, like you say, he was there for those sessions, but I think it was near the end. I mean, they went away, and as you say, there was some real friction between him and Jimmy, and I think there was one incident where Jimmy apparently made Linda cry. He was just being so awful. He himself described him as a Jekyll and Hyde character.
Yeah.
And I find it really weird that despite that, Paul stuck up for him. You know, he kept in the band for a good couple more years, and it was Jeff who had to go.
Yeah, that's true. And I think Paul seems really thrilled to have Jimmy McCullough in the band, because the first song is Junior's Farm, which they made in Nashville, which was when that Jeff Britton lineup is getting broken in. And That solo that he takes comes really early in the song, and Paul goes, "Take it away, Jimmy," like announcing his new guitar player. And same thing with the Venus and Mars album. I mean, Rock Show and even the little intro song, Venus and Mars, has Jimmy on 12-string opening the album. And then Rock Show is just a major guitar fest, especially for McCartney. You know, it's and he's really giving Jimmy McCullough a lot of room. By the next album or so, it's more keyboard based, and Jimmy McCullough doesn't have a lot to do. And then he ends up leaving the band and joining his 13th or 14th band in his, brief career. Well, he started as a teenager and died at age 29 of an overdose or related to that. So, but really I love his guitar sound, and it gives this album a lot of grit, same just as it does with Junior's Farm. So it plays against that constant criticism of McCartney as too light, if Lennon's saying he makes granny music, he's like, well, look at this guy in my band now. It gives the band a different, harder sound for a little while on some songs.
Absolutely. Yeah. As you say, they went to Nashville for a 7-week stay, and it was here that obviously Jimmy and Jeff fell out. They had a lot of visitors, including Roy Orbison and David Cassidy, of all people.
Cassidy keeps turning up everywhere.
He does, There's another story about Jimmy McCulloch and David Cassidy, which I won't go into.
Oh, but, I don't know that one. That's good.
They weren't the best of friends, basically. And, and they recorded, things like Junior's Farm, Sally G, and Walking in the Park with Eloise, which his dad, Jim, wrote.
I love that story when Paul says to his father, Dad, we recorded a song that you wrote. He said, I didn't write it. He said, yes, you did. He said, no, I just made it up.
So it was all going on. And there's a lot of stuff going on with John at the time as well. Obviously, the Beatles had dissolved or were about to dissolve. And there was a lot of will they, won't they going on at the time, despite the fact that Paul, of all of them, really didn't need to at this time. If you think of chart success.
They are really flirting openly with, through the press. John says late 74 and I think again in early 75 that he wouldn't mind a reunion. John has a number one hit in the US. So that's November 74 when Paul is starting to make Venus and Mars. So he's, having a good period. Ringo's had a ton of hits in like 73 and early 74. And into the next year, that's when Paul has seen John in Los Angeles a few times when John is on his Lost Weekend, and they seem to be getting along all right. And even in the fall in New York after the Los Angeles visits, there are reports that they saw each other with May Pang in New York City, and Paul invited John to join him in New Orleans to make Venus and Mars or to in some way help out or co-write. And it didn't happen because John moved back home to the Dakota.
And oddly enough, it was Paul who was instrumental in getting the reunion as well.
Yeah, the story is that he spoke with Yoko and she told Paul what John needed to do to come back. He had to, be nice, romance her a little bit. And Paul delivered that message to John in Los Angeles during the trip. That period is really productive for John Lennon, but if you read the stories too, it's also it is not called The Lost Weekend for no reason. I mean, he was like howling in the street and they had to tie him to a chair at one point, and there's a lot of horrible things that go on. So I can understand where he might want the peace and quiet of the Dakota building for a while. Yeah.
There's stories about when they were recording Pussycats, when they were doing Subterranean Homesick Blues on Amyl Nitrate, I believe it was. Mm-hmm. And apparently take one, it was yakety sack speed. It was just so fast. John said when they meet up with Paul and Linda with May Pang, he described them as Beaujolais evenings reminiscing about old times. So they were all in a good place up to that point, I think.
Yeah, and then the Beatles formally dissolve in December 74, right before the Venus and Mars session really gets started. So Lennon signed the papers in Disney World, and that was the formal end of the Beatles. So they're really free after this to do it. If they do work together, they don't owe some strange third party money. You know, they can work out a new deal if they want to, I think.
Yeah. And at this point, obviously, now Joe English has replaced Jeff on drums. Jeff, I think it really came to a head when they were about to go on tour and his foot was in plaster due to a karate injury.
It's a little hard to play.
And also, he said he didn't really know that many of the older songs, so things like Live and Let Die. Bit of a, you know, challenge. Yeah,
he had a broken foot and he wasn't really a Wings fan. Other than that, he was a good fit.
And he said his succinct description of Denny Lane was a bastard. And his even more succinct comment about Jimmy was, he's a cunt. I'll bleep that out.
Sitting in the stand of the sports arena, waiting for the show to begin. Red lights, green lights, strawberry wine. A good friend of mine follows the stars. Venus and Mars are all right tonight.
So should we move on to the album?
Sure, yeah.
And we start with track one, Venus and Mars.
Well, this kind of sets a mood. It's a fanfare song like Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band and Magical Mystery Tour. It's one of these songs that's announcing something's coming, get ready, everybody. I love the sound of it. The 12-string guitar is really out front. And this is the period where the blending of acoustic guitars and synthesizers may be at its height. I think this is the same year as Wish You Were Here from Pink Floyd. And yeah, it's just something that's in the air. And the synths have a really nice sound on Venus and Mars. They're not on every song, but when they come in, I just love it. And it doesn't sound... There can be cheesy synths and there are non-cheesy synths. And this one in the song Venus and Mars comes in. It sounds great. It's only a little more than a minute long. It really does seem to be part of Rock Show. It's might as well be one song. I mean, McCartney songs are divided into parts so often anyway, so it seems a little arbitrary to call it its own song. But I think it's a nice opener. Do you like it?
Oh, I love it. I think from the offset, it's clearly an album that's made for touring.
Yeah.
Before we were recording, we were just saying the similarities. Again, you're citing Pink Floyd. This is a very, I think the reprise version of this more so, but it's very Pink Floyd in its, you know, surreal imagery and use of synthesizers. But also, again, the packaging on the album, which Hypnosis, who were doing, you know, everybody from Pink Floyd, 10cc, Zeppelin, and Paul chose them to do this, and they've done an amazing job.
Yeah, it's really cool looking. Paul was also into sci-fi at the time. He'd read the Isaac Asimov novel Foundation, which is great. Recommend that. And then he gave Asimov an idea for a sci-fi movie that he wanted to do. And the idea was that there were extraterrestrials posing as a Earth rock band, and Wings would play both parts, the Earth band that was, and also the imposters from outer space. And I read that this Asimov treatment, McCartney rejected it. And then he went to Gene Roddenberry, who created Star Trek, to try again. Nothing worked out, but there is, you can kind of feel underneath this album, there's a little bit of a concept album wanting to get out. Like there are little sci-fi moments here and there, but Paul also came up with other songs that have nothing to do with that, and they're just all together here in this one album. But especially in Venus and Mars and the reprise where the synthesizers really go wacky in a pleasurable way, you can feel like he had this movie in the back of his mind, maybe. I guess he didn't get to it until he did that that video, the 5 years later, Silly Love Songs video. Is that part of Broad Street where they look like a futuristic their Wings becomes Devo. Yeah.
Oh, thank goodness Robin Braid said no.
Yeah. We'd have another giant movie in the middle of McCartney's career. Like,
we'll be right back. track one and track two pretty well segue into each other. So track two, and again, these two were released as a single, but we'll talk about the LP version first, is Rock Show.
Yeah, the thing I love about Rock Show, I mean, it's the ultimate, or one of the ultimate 70s arena rock songs. You know, you can almost hear the mullets in it. You know, Paul has a mullet and Linda has a shag haircut at this time. And they're probably double neck guitars on stage for this one. And by the end, the cowbell gets louder and louder as the song goes on. But by the end, it's almost all you can hear is the cowbell. Yeah. But the thing I love about it is there are like four distinct parts. So there's the main verse and then the first bridge, which is the lights go down, they're back in town, that part. It has like handbells and harmony, a real tempo shift, and then it goes back. And then the next bridge is a completely different thing where in my green metal suit, I'm preparing to shoot up the city, and Paul's doing this posh British accent, which to me, and growing up in New Jersey, was sounded very cool. I was like, whoa. And then at the very end of the song, as if it's not enough, Paul gives you this Alan Toussaint on piano, and they do this thing where Paul's saying, come on, we're going to the rock show, you know, with a very cool riff. And it's an all new part because he just keeps giving, like these melodies just keep jumping out of his head and onto the record. You know, it sounds great. So there's so much variety in that song. When they make it a single, they try to pack it into like 3 minutes and 30 seconds, and it really is a mess. You know, it doesn't sound right. I can never hear the single. And I wish it wasn't on Wingspan, for instance. I think that's the single version.
Yeah, it's like the single version of Won't Get Fooled Again.
Yeah, right.
Why do it? Leave
do,
it.
Do you? What are your memories of this song? Do you remember hearing it ever, or what?
Well, it was because I kind of got into Wings when I was a teenager, so I just used to pick stuff up. I said the one I've got is from a charity shop from the 80s, I think, and that was about £3. And it's got all the inserts in it. I was chuffed to bits. But no, I think this song, as you say, all the different segments, it just blends together as one long, beautiful piece of music. And again, that coda is just fantastic.
Yeah. I'm surprised that coda hasn't been sampled because I think it could work as, you know, on a loop. It would be great.
Yeah. And some great rhyming. Rock Show, Concert Gabot, Long Hair, Madison Square, Rock and Roll, Hollywood Bowl. There you go.
I mean, he should get credit for the lyrics for a song like this because it's a rave up rock song, but the lyrics are not embarrassing or stupid. And he has, you know, the tension mounts, you score an ounce. So he gets his pot reference in there, even though Linda was busted that year, you know, and
he still claims it was planted, doesn't he?
The kids were in the back seat. It was, you know, that was in LA. It's just amazing.
Incidentally, have you seen Sergeant Pilcher has got a book coming out?
Oh, really?
Talking of planting.
That's incredible.
My heart cries out for love and all that goes with loving, loving song, loving song. You're so fine when love is mine. I can't go wrong. Loving song. Loving song.
Track three, Loving Song.
Well, this to me feels like one of the McCartney beautiful ballads that's sort of fallen through the cracks. I don't know if has he ever played it live since then, or I'm not sure.
I don't know. No.
And it's just a beautiful song and feels natural. There's nothing forced about it, though. It's just it's just a simple love song. It has such melancholy and heartbreak under the surface, although there's nothing in the words that's, making you think something tragic has happened or anything. There's beautiful, the recording of the drums is great. There's some background percussion that sounds just great. McCartney's the producer here, as he was for Band on the Run. And I mean, he has Jeff Emmerich and others as engineers, but it reminds me that he wasn't chasing other people's sounds at this point. You know, he was still the one being chased. You know, he was on top of it. It's not until, is it Back to the Egg, where he hires an outside producer to really come in, and because I guess he was a little freaked after London Town, like, am I now out of what the market wants, you know? But yeah, he didn't have that worry at this point. He's just making the production he wants to make, and it sounds just right. It's just a really cool song, and again, with acoustic 12 strings, some harp in there, and the Moog synthesizer, I think it is, comes in, and it's just very confident and a beautiful kind of semi-forgotten song.
I can see
Achingly Beautiful. Achingly Beautiful is, this is the song for me. I put this in his top 10 solo songs of all time. I absolutely love it. I think, obviously, it was one of the first. So it's Geoff Britton on drums, and it's recorded at Abbey Road in late 74. Paul's playing Bill Black's stand up bass on this, apparently.
Oh, yeah.
But I think, yeah, for me, it's possibly my favourite of all of Linda's vocals when she comes in on the harmony. And she only comes in about three quarters of the way through when she starts, I can see the places that we used to go to now. It's just one of, I don't know why, it's just one of the most moving pieces of music.
It really is.
I don't know if it's an astonishingly beautiful song.
Yep. Yeah. It's so good, it's hard to talk about. Because it's, you know, when it's that good, it's just, you just have to listen to it.
Yeah, you do, you just get absorbed.
You gave me the answer to love eternally. I love you and you seem to like me. Wherever we wander, the local folk agree. I love you and you seem to like me.
And then Paul, being as contrary as ever, follows that with track 4, You Gave Me the Answer.
Yeah, I mean, this song is perfectly done, Fred Astaire kind of a song, Cole Porter in that territory, and yet, like, why is he doing it? He's really perverse, because just 2 years before, he had his TV special James Paul McCartney, and he did a huge Busby Berkeley style number called "Gotta Sing, Gotta Dance," which I think he wrote that song as well. It's never been released. I assumed that it was an old song that he revived, but it wasn't. And he got torn apart for it. I mean, on that TV special, there was not only that big song and dance number, there was also Mary Had a Little Lamb, and the poor guys in Wings at the time look like they're, you know, conscripts or something, like they've been forced, you know, into the ridiculous military of children's songs or something. And now here he's
back.
Which
he threw back at them as well, because he later said, yeah, well, they should have stood up to me, you know? I should have said to them.
Yeah, right.
I like blaming them.
Yeah. Why didn't somebody say something? And now here he is back again. The album is going so well. You know, Venus and Mars rock show is great. You know, great rocker. Lovin' Song is like a, you know, state-of-the-art ballad for the time. And then he's got to come in with this 1920s style Rudy Toot song, as he calls them, in his When I'm 64 mode. But it's a great song, and even when I was 11 years old, I didn't skip it. You know what I mean? It's just pure pleasure. It has a really long instrumental passage. You know, it's written in that Tin Pan Alley structure, where it's just, you know, A section, A section, B section, final A section, and not the rock style of verse, chorus, bridge, you know, that thing. So it's really well done. And I just wonder if it's kind of Paul giving the middle finger to the people who don't like this side of him by putting it so prominently on the album. I mean, the album's really just getting started, you know? Yeah. So,
which is pretty well what he did with Silly Love Songs, I guess.
Yeah.
Same principle. I wonder if it's because, obviously, they previously recorded Walking in the Park with Eloise.
Yeah.
And obviously, his father was very ill at the time, because I think he died the following year. So maybe it was a, you know, this is for you, Dad, perhaps.
Yeah. There's no other explanation for him to do it except that he means it. Like, he's compelled to do it. It's part of what he, you know, music hall is just a big part of what he needs to get out. So here it is. Here it is again. But I do like it. You know, there's nothing wrong with it. It's just you kind of question the wisdom of like why it's almost like he's trolling part of his audience, you know?
Yeah.
Although we didn't have that word back then.
No. But Paul once again ahead of the game.
Yeah. Well, I was talking last night.
Track 5, Magneto and Titanium Man.
Well, this is such a delight, this song, to me. It just rolls along. I love the feel of it. It goes into some unexpected places melodically, you know. I love how the words sit in the melody, like swung all over that long, tall bank in the main street. Even if it's nonsensical, yeah. It's a lot of fun. It's based on, you know, Marvel characters that Paul yeah. Paul was reading comic books in Jamaica. Supposedly there was a place there that he would buy the latest Marvel comic books that, or maybe old ones, for him and his kids. And, and on the tour, the creators, I believe at least one of them, it's Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, saw Wings show in LA and met Paul. You know, they loved the song. And when he did the song live, there would be, images of Magneto and Titanium Man and the Crimson Dynamo and the whole crew on, you know, projected on stage. So I guess he's also a little ahead with the Marvel thing, because really back then it was not, you know, there was not that much, you know, not like it is now where pop culture, things like that were taken somewhat seriously. And it's just a fun song. It in a way reminds me of a lot of these story songs of that time that made no sense, that like Dylan specialized in, like, what's that one on Blood on the Tracks, Jack, Rosemary, and the Lily of, I forget the name of that one, and Black Diamond Bay on Desire, where you're trying to follow the story and it's almost not possible, but it's still fun anyway. It's just a cascade of images. And so I always enjoy this song and I'm glad when it comes up. And how about you? What do you think?
Yeah, it's weird you mentioned Dylan, because it always reminds me of Highway 61 Revisited. Mm. You've got the same rhythm and the same kind of story.
You're right.
Such as it is.
Actually, you're right.
Yep. And I do love the fact that it gets so confusing, but Paul, he still throws in, you know the one I mean? You know? Yeah. You've been following the lyrics of this song, and I'm going to start testing you.
Yep, that's right. Also, it seems like he switches sides at the end, because I think he's on the side of the robbers, and then they get... I don't know. You couldn't cut it no more. You were the law. It just doesn't make sense by the end of it. But
no. For anybody who wants to know, the two Marvel comics it's primarily inspired by are the cover of the X-Men number 91, which shows the mutant hero battling the power of Magneto, and also the cover of Avengers number 130. Which features a number of superhero nemesis such as the Crimson Dynamo, Slasher, Titanium Man, and Radioactive Man. And that's my knowledge of Marvel.
Probably in 10 years they'll all have their own movie, each one of those characters.
Yeah. But yeah, I think it's a fantastic song. It's nice to hear Paul doing all of his different character voices as well. Yeah. He effortlessly flits to from one verse to the other. And the final track on side one is Letting Go, again recorded late 74 in Abbey Road.
Some great guitar work here by Jimmy McCullough, and it just sets a great swampy kind of mood in the beginning of the song. I always feel like it's a sibling song to Let Me Roll It. Do you feel that way at all?
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
a little more straightforward than Let Me Roll It, which is a little more innovative. But this song is starts off so great. The guitar sound is great. It's just the first verse, a simple love song. Paul is so in love that he feels like letting go. He's going to surrender himself for once. You know, it all, you know, it sounds like he kind of knows, or the narrator of the song knows, that he's a controlling person. And then it all comes apart in the later verses, because suddenly I want to put you in a Broadway show. And and then the words, I don't understand it, when I want to put her in a Broadway show. And then you're imagining, what does that look like? Ah, she'll dance and dine. So there's why is she dining? I don't know why. And then the third verse, he's not content that she's a Broadway star. Now he wants to make her a star on the radio. Yeah. One day there you are. So from the start of the song, where it's a song of like surrendering to love, Paul has now taken over the career of his beloved and put her on a stage, which he did in real life as well. So it's a bit, but maybe the lyrics aren't really the point of this one, but sometimes all you need is that good first verse and a good chorus and a good sound.
Yeah. I think we were saying before we started doing this, these songs are now being credited to Paul and Linda McCartney, but on both our versions, it's just all songs by Paul.
So yeah.
Not sure what's happened there.
Probably has something to do with Sir Lou Grade. Because wasn't there? Him. Yeah, there was some fight over money and the crediting of Linda. Who knows? And also, probably, I wonder if there are some tax reasons, because Paul said he recorded this album in America partly because of... for tax reasons.
Yeah.
Yeah. And not only that, composed by Paul McCartney, it says on mine. They're composed.
Yeah.
So
he's a canny one, that boy. Yeah, again, this was released as a single, but just peaked at 41 in the UK and 39 in the US. Don't know if it's... I suppose it is a single. It's got some pretty good brass on there.
Yeah. Yeah, the brass really kicks in at the end. I guess to make some use of New Orleans, where they were recording a lot of this album.
And we flip over to side two. And it's Venus and Mars reprise. Slightly different lyrics this time. Mm-hmm. More space age, which we were talking about earlier.
Even more sci-fi, the lyrics for this one. It makes a lot more sense on a vinyl, if you have the vinyl copy of this album, because it opens side two, whereas if you find it on streaming or in a CD, it's just kind of sitting in the middle and it's back. I mean, it still works, but... yeah, as we talked about before, the synths really sound great at the end of this song. And then, like the opening Venus and Mars, it fades into the next song, Spirits of Ancient Egypt. Spirits of Ancient Egypt.
So track two, Spirits of Ancient Egypt, with Denny on vocals.
The best part of this song is the opening 20 seconds, where it's as Venus and Mars is fading into it, and it has a great sound. I had long assumed that Denny Lane wrote this song, and he didn't. McCartney wrote this song and gave it to Denny to sing. And is it cruel to read the first three lines of the song?
I mean, go for it.
You're my baby and I love you. You can take a pound of love and cook it in the stew. It's just, and the delivery doesn't help. Nothing can help. I mean, unless it's meant as a joke, I don't think it is. I'm not sure what's going on. And I honestly suspect that Paul had this Spirits of Ancient Egypt chorus, which is vaguely pretty cool. And then he needed something to go with it, and he just came up with this kind of bluesy, you know, run of the mill song and you know, put it together as one song. And I think it's really kind of lower tier McCartney. And yet on the tour, they played it. It's, you know, it's on Wings Over America. It's like the fourth song and or fifth song on that album too. So it comes early.
Mm.
So it was a song that was highlighted.
I mean, it was inspired by a book on the Great Pyramids of Egypt, which Chet Atkins, of all people, told Paul about during his Nashville trip. But I think the thing for me, I wonder if it's because the next song, which we'll talk about in a few minutes, Medicine Jar, which is a Jimmy McCulloch song, I'm wondering if it was a democratic thing, because Denny, you know, he's given Jimmy a song on the album. Denny hasn't got anything. Maybe Denny hadn't written anything. And Paul wanted, you know, I don't know if it's, you know, Denny's been there from the start and this new Royster Doyster's coming in. He's got a track. I don't know.
That has to be it. But I would think that Denny could have written one song, and it's been 2 years since Band on the Run almost. So, but he doesn't have one, I guess. That must be it.
Yeah, if you look at the timeline, all of them are quite enjoying themselves, maybe. They didn't have time.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we move on to track three, Medicine Jar. Again, Jimmy McCulloch and drummer Colin Allen composed this.
Yeah, Colin Allen wrote the lyrics, and like Jimmy's other song, Wino Junko, Colin Allen wrote the lyrics to that as well, and they're both warning against, you know, overindulgence. And yeah. And a lot of people have mentioned that that's how Jimmy McCulloch died. But I like this song a lot. I like the directness of the opening, you know, what's wrong with you? I wish I knew. Those are kind of lyrics you don't hear on a McCartney album. You can tell that Jimmy's a different generation. I almost feel like he belonged in the pub rock movement. He would have been right at home there. And there, here he is in Wings at 23 years old or so. He just has a different attack, you know, and it works well here. It's nice to hear. It's kind of refreshing. You know, it's pretty much a bluesy jam, this song. I think Wino Junko is more interesting as a song, you know, than this one. It is really cool. But it's a fine, you know, it's not a skipper, Medicine Jar, for me. Is it for you? Do you listen to it?
It is a bit of a skipper. I do agree, though. I think he, as a guitarist, as a personality, he would have been more suited into that pop rock era. Something like Dr. Feelgood or bands like that.
Yep.
That kind of thing. Was it the Small Faces he joined after this?
Yeah, he was in like the not final, but one of the very late versions of the Small Faces after this. Yep.
Yeah, I think Wings, what he brought to Wings was probably more than what Wings brought to Jimmy, perhaps.
Yeah. Although he was in a lot of obscure bands, and this, we still know about him because of his work with Wings, on the other hand, and, you know, those guitar solos that he was allowed to, you know, go to town with on Junior's Farm and elsewhere, you know, that's why we still remember him mainly, I think.
Well, when I walk on holes, just a little baby boy.
Track four, Call Me Back Again.
This is in, you know, Paul and Oh Darling mode. It's a kind of a early 60s R&B style screamer. A little bit like Backseat of My Car, that which is more elaborate than this song. It never did that much for me somehow, even though it's a good performance. There's nothing that I can point to that's, you know, a problem exactly. I guess it's Paul in New Orleans mode. There's a lot of horns, and it's just one of those songs that's a bit of a chore sometimes to listen to for me. But how about you?
Yeah, I'll go. it seems longer than it is.
Yeah, it does.
And it's got that, again, the amazing horn section Tony Dorsey wrote, which is astonishing. But it's Paul is ripping his, you know, vocals to shreds, but I don't know, it's kind of soulless with me.
Yeah, I don't know what the matter is. Maybe because he was trying to write this kind of song too consciously, and it's hard to do, you know.
Yeah, paper, as you say, it's the same format as Oh Darling.
Yeah.
Yet they're a world apart.
Yeah, it just feels kind of dead somehow, no matter what. No matter how much he screams. Yeah, so.
Yeah. And somebody, actually, who was it? Yeah, Nick Tarizo. He suggested that the lyrics could possibly be directed at John Lennon.
Ah.
Which would add a huge twist.
That would. Call Me Back Again. There's a lot of telephone on this album. Spirits of Ancient Egypt is hung on the telephone. This one, you know, so.
Oh. Hung on the phone, hung on the phone. Move on to track 5, Listen to What the Man Said, which was absolutely huge. It was a US number 1 and number 6 in the UK.
Yeah, this song is so unusual, even though it's catchy. You know, it's a weird little song, and it's yet incredibly catchy. It has this great, like, skipping rhythm in the beginning. The percussion is so cool. The guitar riff that repeats is, I think, Dave Mason is playing that. Sounds really good. It's you know, between, you know, Twee McCartney and Rock McCartney, somewhere right in between the two. It's a lot of fun, and like the summer before in the US, Band on the Run was the big song that summer, and then this summer of 75, Listen to What the Man Said was, you know, you heard it a lot everywhere you went. And then on top of it, you've got Tom Scott on the soprano sax. They brought him in late in the session to add something to the track. I think Paul thought it was needed something more. And he plays, it's like wall-to-wall soprano sax. I mean, maybe there's a little, maybe we could, you know, if you're on Pro Tools now, you could, like, you know, highlight a section of it and hit delete here and there. But I mean, it sounds pretty good. Also,
one take.
Yeah, one take. So that's great. I also love... It's a weird structure. There are two verses, so it's a big hit with a strange structure in that it begins with a verse, another verse, and then the rest of the song is the chorus over and over again until he hits The Wonder of It All, Baby, which is a new section, and then another coda where it slows down and the strings really swell and gives it a big finish, which I love. So it's just really cool how McCartney can have a hit with a song that breaks a lot of the rules of the typical pop hits of the time and song structure.
Yeah, but it doesn't sound contrived.
It doesn't at all.
Different sections.
Yeah, you don't notice it unless you look at it. Yeah, that it does that.
Oh yeah, and you've got the vocal opening with all the, which is apparently Leo Nocentelli. Is that how you pronounce it? Who was guitarist with the Meters?
Yeah. So is that him or is it Paul imitating him? I was never sure.
Yeah, Paul imitating
him.
Yeah.
All right, okay. Very good to see you down in New Orleans, man. Yeah, Harry.
Yeah. But yeah, it absolutely gallops along with song.
Yeah.
It's just perfection. I remember very, very young as a kid, it was just on the radio all the time. I think we said before we were going to do this, from my perception, this is a very American-sounding album.
Mm-hmm.
But you were saying you can pick up, from your perspective, a lot of Englishness.
Oh, yeah.
Which I find interesting.
Well, we didn't talk about the oys on Rock Show, and I always wondered if that's one of the first oy on a record.
Yeah.
So in my green metal suit, I'm preparing to shoot up the city, and Wing and Denny, especially in the background, is going, oy, you know. And
yeah.
so there are things like that that, yeah, struck me as very English, you know, as a kid in New Jersey, hearing this. But maybe that's the most English moment. Oh, also, well, we'll get to it later, but the
yeah.
final song. So, yeah.
I'm keen to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah. But, and also the harmonies on Listen to What the Man Said Again,
oh.
like the Wings harmonies here. Linda gets a lot of crap, and she shouldn't, because she adds, you know, such a distinctive
yeah.
sound to Wings. It's what really makes, it's part of what makes Paul's solo career distinct from his Beatles career, you know, is, you know, he's presenting himself as a father, a family man, and he's not hiding it. I mean, when he went on tour for this album, he had the kids with him as usual, even though they had the Wings playing. So he's in this weird Netherland between, you know, the rock star of the 70s with his own plane, and yet he's got his family aboard. And on the cover of People magazine at the time, you know, I think the story was called like Daddy McCartney, you know, so they were, you know, he didn't shy away from it. It was a new thing for a rock star to be a family man. You know, Dylan did it to some degree when he went to Nashville, but he wasn't doing much press, and and when he presented himself to the public again in 74, he was very much in loner on the road mode, not he wasn't showing the world that he was a family man at the time. So it is kind of breaking new ground in a weird way that people don't really think about. Rock stars were supposed to be these alien beings who just partied and did strange things. And Paul was kind of, you know, combining regular home life with what he did for a living.
Yeah. Well, you think other bands from the 60s that moved on to the Stones and the Who, Led Zeppelin, you know, their tours were going to be a lot more nefarious than, say, a Wings tour. But he didn't, as you say, he didn't shy away from it. You know, there's no stories of sharks or anything with Wings, I hope. But,
yeah, no. The worst story I've seen was that I think it's Denny and Jimmy got in the cockpit and the pilots allowed them to take control of the plane. Now, I hope this is one of the reputable McCartney books. I think it is in the Tom Boyd book, which is very good. And the plane went into a bit of a dive, and Paul had to, you know, his kids are on the plane, and it's, you know, they're fooling around in the cockpit, his two guitar players. It's not a great idea. So I think they were reprimanded for that.
Treat her gently, treat her kind. She doesn't even know her own mind. Treat her simply, take it slow.
We move on to the penultimate track, which is another medley, Treat Her Gently and Lonely Old People.
Again, as with Love and Song, just a melody that feels so natural and inspired. It might be a little more syrupy in the lyrics on this song, but I find it interesting that we're about 8 years after Eleanor Rigby, and Paul is returning to singing about old people or lonely people.
Mm.
And when he did it in 66, or when he was an outsider, you know, he was an observer writing a song in the third person about Eleanor Rigby and Father McKenzie. And it was also very much a young person's idea of how pathetic these lonely old people were in some way. I mean, that song, Eleanor Rigby, is obviously one of the great songs and has compassion in it, but you can tell there's some kind of progression in his mind when he returns to this topic here, and he's singing about it in the first person. You know, here we sit, two lonely old people. is this something that just floated through his mind when he's sitting with Linda in Jamaica, or does it happen when he sees John Lennon and realizes that they're older now, you know, than they were, you know? And it's a bit weird in that the treat her gently, treat her kind, treat her simply, whoever he's talking about here is almost portrayed as like a defective or something. And then here we set these lonely, I mean, there's a lot of pathetic material here in this song. And again, like you gave me the answer, this is the thing that puts off some McCartney fans. But I think like the melody wins out. It's a heartfelt sentiment. It is a beautiful song. The production is so great. I mean, what, I don't understand what happened to him as a producer in some way. I mean, I guess he never quite lost it, but he just lost confidence as a producer later when he hired other people. What do you think of it? Do you think it goes over the line into sentimentality, or do you like it?
I don't know. It's as you say, the treat her gently. He's almost singing to a man. Treat her gently. Treat her kind.
Yeah.
And then it's here we sit. So you never quite get a perspective of who he's singing to. So I find that confusing. And yeah, it does veer into sentimentality. But you know, who else was doing that?
Yeah.
The Who, the Stones, Angie's about as sentimental as they got, I think.
Yeah.
At that sort of era. And why not? He's, you know, it's Paul.
Yeah. The funny thing about the song is in the bridge where it's old people's home for the day, that part, for no reason that makes any sense in the context of the lyrics, Paul lets out a big falsetto, yeah, 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 and he does it twice. And I almost feel like he's so thrilled with how great his melody is that he's just going like, yeah, 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 you know. So the yeah, yeah, yeah is really the height of emotion in the song. And I honestly don't know what it means. It's just he's kind of exulting right there in the middle. It sounds great, but I don't, you know, it just comes out of, you know, when you're singing about people in a nursing home and then you scream, yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, the last time he sang yeah, yeah, yeah was like 63, and it was a very different reason. Yeah. So it's a weird bookend to, you know.
Maybe it's one of the wardens in the old folks home. You know, just, right. Okay. And we close with Tony Hatch's Crossroads theme. So as a New Yorker, I'm keen to hear your perspective on this.
This song always puzzled me as a kid. I kind of like, you know, it reminds me of, you know, the band, the wedding band is still on stage and they're clearing the tables and, you know, the chairs are being turned upside down and, you know, it feels like the hall is emptying out and that's all it sounds like. But then I read later that it's the theme song for one of those long running British soap operas. And there it is at the end of this album, seemingly for no reason, except Paul likes the melody. What do you think of it when you hear it, and how does it? What is the soap opera? I don't know what that show is.
Right.
Crossroads.
Where do I start? Right, I remember this. It's one of my earliest memories. There are two main at the time soap operas. There's one, Coronation Street, which has been going on since '64, I think it was, still going today, and it's sort of northern working class folk getting by. Crossroads was kind of a rip off of that, and it was based in a motel. My memories of it, even as a 6-7 year old, were it was abysmal. Even then, the acting was, you know, not great, and some of the sets would wobble. As you know, if they shut the door, the wall wouldn't wobble. It was very cheap budget TV. And Kate Robbins, oddly, who was one of our previous guests, she was on it.
Oh, wow!
She had a character on it, and she was saying that there was an interview where she said, quite often, a lot of the cast would be drunk when they were filming it.
Hey, got me here. Perhaps you'd be good enough to tell me what you intend to do.
Have my wife's bags taken to my chalet, please?
Certainly, sir.
That for a start. Now, I suggest we sit down and have a drink. You may need one. There are going to be some big changes. Like them or not.
I think it went out live. People might correct me, but I think it went out live. I'd say as the best perspective, Victoria Wood, if you have a look at something she did called Acorn Antiques, which was a spoof of Crossroads with really overtly bad acting and bad scripts, that is the level of soap opera we're talking about.
I'll look that up.
Your coffee, Miss Babs. What's wrong now?
Oh, nothing. Just a rather mysterious phone call from the Far East.
Well, sometimes that's God's way of telling you to think on and look sharp.
You're right. Gosh, I am awful. Here I am blabbing away about my own troubles, and I forgot to ask you about your husband's car crash.
Oh, he's dead, Miss Babs. Yes, in fact, I was going to ask you if I could have a couple of hours off on Thursday for the funeral.
Of course. Just pop back at 5 for the hoovering.
But Paul, his quote was, "It's a joke. It's after lonely old people. They're sitting in the park saying, nobody asked us to play. It's a poignant moment. Then there's a little break and then Crossroads starts up. It's lonely old people. It's just the kind of thing that lonely old people watch. It could just easily have been Coronation Street, but we knew the chords to Crossroads."
It's hilarious. And it shows some self-awareness, I guess. I mean, it seems like he's critiquing the previous song with this one, if it's true that that's what he was doing.
Yeah.
It also shows his reluctance to have a grand album closer. He loves to he loves to do a throwaway number at the end, which I kind of like. Yeah.
Well, I think what you were saying there is the perfect description. It's the, you know, the staff at the wedding putting the chairs on the table.
Yeah.
It's,
yeah,
you know, closing music. So, Jim Windolf, thank you so much for this. What are your overall thoughts on this, some would say, underrated album, despite its success?
Yeah, very. It has its own world, this album. That's what I feel like. You kind of go into it. It has a special, distinctive sound, even though there's a lot of variety in it. It feels like a coherent work. It's kind of best listened to all at once to have... Listen to What the Man Said and something like Rock Show on the same record, and You Gave Me the Answer. The side two, if you're listening to it as a vinyl album, that's where the weakness comes through. You know, there's a little string of songs there that are, you know, not so hot, but it's got at least, you know, 7 or 8 songs that are really good. And then Lovin' Song is kind of the forgotten classic. I think you and I talking about it, it really, really stands out that this song has kind of fallen away from, I feel like people in the last few years are going through McCartney's stuff because they're becoming more aware that how great he was. And as much as he's celebrated, what is he in some way underappreciated? So I think there's a lot of these podcasts are about, like, let's examine his body of work and see what's there. And I think when you do that, you find things like Love and Song. It's like, ooh, you know, it's like, or I came across like Heaven on a Sunday. Is that the name of that song recently? And
yeah.
That was one I was not that aware of. And I was like, oh, geez, this is here too, you know? So you find these scattered songs where you're, you know, that I think you realize were special and maybe we ignored them at the time, you know, to some degree. So I don't know if it's in anybody's top 5 Paul McCartney albums. It probably is with some people. I'm not sure if it's in mine, but it's close. You know, it's a very good, solid record and interesting for the time in McCartney's career that it falls in, you know, when he's really at the top of his game commercially and about to go on a huge tour and yet with the family and the whole thing. How about you? How do you see the record as a whole? Do you ever turn to it or...
Strangely, no. I remember every time I put it on, I can't take it off. It's a whole journey, as they say. But it's just not one of those you think of. It's not one that you have. you can be in any mood, I think, to listen to this. Sometimes you need to be in a particular mood to listen to something a bit spikier, like Back to the Egg.
Yeah.
And sometimes you've got to be in a different mood to listen to a mellow London Town or something like that. This, I think, you can listen to in any mood, and it's a great album. But it doesn't, I don't know why, it just doesn't figure in my, when I think of a Wings album.
It's very funny.
Bizarre. So thank you very much, Jim. I much appreciate it. And all the best.
All right. Thanks so much, Chris.
I'm asking you to marry me.